Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org. Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org. And the planets of the
universe go their way. NASA's Kepler satellite has identified three planets far, far away that could sustain life. We'll talk about this discovery this hour and other space-related news. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, April 23rd. We'll welcome your questions about and your reactions to the possibility of life on other planets outside our solar system. And we want to know what you are watching in the night skies these days or what you are looking forward to seeing in this year that has been dubbed by some the Year of the Comet. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Chris Janssen, Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. It's great to be back.
Yes, nice to have you back. Are you getting some snow this morning in Wausau?
Oh, not yet. Okay. Yesterday.
You had some yesterday. Yeah, there's some heavy snow, especially for northwestern Wisconsin still today. Yeah, up to a foot of snow on April 23rd. Ugh. Anyway, so tell us about this. This news broke last week that the Kepler satellite discovered three planets that are potentially habitable. So tell us about these planets.
Okay. Well, the first thing, when you hear an announcement like this, you have to take this with a grain of salt, because Kepler has certain abilities of detection and certain abilities it does not. The only thing Kepler can really detect is there is a large opaque body moving in front of a star and about the size of that body and its orbit. And so everything else beyond that is complete assumption, speculation. So these particular objects that have been discovered, the reason they're so exciting is because they are Terran size or slightly larger than Earth size. And so if you have a planet about the same size as Earth, and if, according to the orbital telemetry, this data or this planet is within that zone where the temperature is, you know, the Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold, It could have liquid water on it. Not confirmed, could. So these planets discovered are exciting because they're the first, probably of many planets soon to be discovered that could be just like Earth.
And tell us about the this Kepler satellite mission. That's what it's looking for, Earth-like planets?
Yes. The idea of Kepler is really only taking a small area of the sky in the constellation of Cygnus. And they chose that area specifically as a kind of a statistical blasé part of the sky so that this number of planets in this area can then be statistically applied to the rest of the sky. So if they find that of the stars in this little area, you know, 5% of them have planetary systems, then you can ascribe, well, 5% of the rest of the stars have planetary systems. And how Kepler works is really quite straightforward. Many people, when they're at night driving on the highway, they see headlights way off in the distance on a very straight, no-tree highway. Well, if you are driving looking at those oncoming headlights and you see four little legs go across those headlights, You know there's a deer out there in front of you somewhere. And so this is a method called occultation. Something gets in front of a background light source. And so Kepler has just got its eyes trained on these stars in this very small area of the sky, and is just basically monitoring the luminosity from these stars. And as the light dims slightly and then comes back, Kepler can say, aha, that was a planet that just moved in front of the star. And then they can detect how many dips and how big the dips are, and then they can start to piece together the periodicity and quantity of these opaque bodies orbiting these luminous beacons out in space.
So why is Kepler doing this?
To answer really the big question about, you know, of all the stars you see over your head at night, how many of them actually have planetary systems? And so this mission was the first, really, to try to get a handle on the percentage of stars with planets.
Yeah, and in some years ago, Kepler saw another potentially habitable planet?
Oh, yeah, Gliese 581. Wow, that one sparked a huge, because it was one of the first ones. I even saw T-shirts printed. It was premature, though. It was not confirmed by a second study. We have to be careful with these discoveries as scientists because the premise of science is be skeptical. And so I was reading some of the press reports of even this new discovery, Kepler 62, and I mean, if there are aliens, this is what they look like, it, you know, and it's 2.3G, and so they're big and heavy and stocky, and it's dim, so their eyes are big, and it's like, whoa, guys,
goodness.
Slow down.
Yeah, so they named, two of the planets are Kepler 62e and Kepler 62f. So those are catchy names.
Actually, that is interesting. The International Astronomical Union, the official recognized body that names these things, they are being attacked basically by other agencies who are trying to name planets. Alpha Centauri BB, capital BB, there's a name called Rakut, which is being proposed by a third-party agency that claims the IAU doesn't have the authority to name these objects and that it's the citizenry of planet Earth by popular vote. And, of course, they're happy to take your check.
Yeah.
As they run the service to name these objects.
Yeah, we're getting into the weeds a little bit here. But then it says the third planet that's potentially habitable is Kepler 69c. So I'm not sure I understand, but... there we go. And again, these three planets are you're saying they're not necessarily planets, but they're large bodies that are...
Sorry, they are planets, Joe. I didn't mean to mislead. They are basically Terran size, or like maybe 1.5 to 2.5 size of the Earth. They're definitive planets for sure, not gas giants.
Okay, but these planets are within the zone of the star in this solar system that corresponds to Earth's sun. I mean, it's what we assume is the sun of that solar system.
Correct. Yes. Now, the distance of these planets from their host star is not the same as Earth. Basically, the habitable zone is determined by the temperature of that host star. So on planet Earth, we've got a medium temperature star. So we have to be a little bit farther back to have those nice temperatures for liquid water. This particular star is a K-type star, which is a red, dim, cooler star. So these planets are actually much closer to their star to get that Goldilocks temperature. So the habitable zone changes based on the temperature of the host star.
And so now what? What happens now?
Well, Kepler continues. This is, there are many, I think, over 962 planetary systems so far. Kepler is only a fraction of the way through the database. It's going to keep watching because as the longer period planets, the planets that are farther away take a couple of years to orbit their host star, they're not going to occult the host star, on its next period. So Kepler just keeps watching, keeps recording the light curves from these stars, and keeps on chugging forward. Another mission would be, after this, would be to try to point a telescope at these planets and detect if there is water, carbon dioxide, oxygen, and so on, to see if they're actual living planets or not.
We are talking with Chris Janssen. He is Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District, talking about the announcement from NASA last week that its Kepler satellite discovered three planets that could potentially support life. We're welcoming your questions about this discovery, and we're welcoming your thoughts and questions about other happenings in space. What are you watching the skies for? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's going to be a cloudy, cool day today with scattered light rain. The northwestern part of the state could see more heavy snow. Highs today will be in the 40s. Partly cloudy and cold tonight with lows in the 20s and 30s, and turning cloudy again tomorrow with a chance of snow late, highs in the mid to upper 40s. But looks like a real warming trend is coming up for the weekend. We can only hope. Looks like, for example, on Saturday, sunny and very mild with highs in the upper 50s and low 60s. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 3 o'clock, it's At Issue with John Munson. John's guest will tell us how to manage real-life financial challenges by using lessons from the board game Monopoly. That's At Issue with John Munson after 3 on the Ideas Network. After 8 this morning, we'll have financial advice, especially housing advice, from Kevin McKinley. It's another edition of On Your Money, and our housing advice series continues during On Your Money after 8. Right now, we are talking about all things space-related with Chris Janssen, Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District. He joins us from time to time to talk about news from around the universe. Started our discussion talking about the three planets identified by the NASA Kepler satellite last week that could sustain life. And we'll talk about other things that are in the night sky as well. And we're welcoming your questions and your observations at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Chris, I wanted to ask you about this meteor shower that's happening this week. The meteor shower that was, I think it peaked on Monday night, but it's still possible to see the meteors this week?
Oh, yes. We just finished the Lyrid meteor shower, and it's actually kind of a minor shower. We've had some good moon skies, so it was actually, that would be a great thing if we could have maybe some people who are listening who did see some meteors call, because it's neat if you see the color of the streak. Sometimes it leaves a train behind in the sky. The color of that streak indicates if it was a stony or an iron. So if anyone's listening and did see some meteors from the Lyrids and wouldn't mind calling, I'd love to hear about those reports.
Yeah, I would too. It said it was supposed to peak the night of April 22nd and early in the morning on April 23rd. So I guess it's over now, but that was the peak. But it said, according to one article, that you might still see a little bit of it through the 26th or something like that. Is it still happening?
Yeah, the Lyrids are a slower shower. They don't have a really dramatic peak. They measure meteor showers in meteors per hour. So the Lyrids isn't, you know, super the big one. The big one really coming up is in August. Always look forward to it, the Perseid meteor shower. There have been, you know, 50 or more per hour, which is pretty cool. If you think about it, it's like almost one per second, you know, or per minute, excuse me. So the Lyrids weren't going to peak that high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also coming up. This has been dubbed the Year of the Comet, supposedly. There is a big comet headed toward Earth this year.
Yes, this could be big news, Joy, or mm-hmm. It could be the washout of the year. The big comet called ISON, ISON, was discovered basically from its reflectivity. Comets are giant snowballs with some, you know, organic compounds, ammonia and things in there. And as you look out into space, they reflect light like a snowball does, and you can, from that brightness, determine the size of that big snowball. And ISON is big, and as it approaches the sun, it's going to start melting and outgassing this the snowy material. And if everything holds together and ISON isn't a real fluffy snowball but more of an icy, clumpy snowball, they are predictions that ISON could be the comet of the century in October.
Oh, so it's October is when it's arriving. Is that why this year has been dubbed the year of the comet? Are there other comets or just ISON?
Yes, we did have earlier this year a comet called Pan-STARRS, which was smaller and awfully close to the sun. So you had to go out right after sunset, and you might be able to see it with binoculars. Also, there is a comet. Well, this isn't until 2014, but there's going to be a comet coming very close to Mars, which would be very interesting to see if you could be on Mars. I hope they train one of the rover's cameras up to the sky. As far as occurrence probability, boy, there isn't any particular year that is higher as far as the number of comets. You might say it's a coincidence. Comets have extremely wild orbits. They come from the Oort cloud. If we get a couple of them in one year, it's a complete coincidence. They're unrelated to each other.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Chris Janssen. We're talking about all things space-related. He is Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District. What are you looking forward to seeing in the night skies this year? What have you seen? Is there anything that you have been looking for? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Did you see this meteor shower that occurred earlier this week? How about Northern Lights? Have you seen? There were some Northern Lights. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. About last week, there was some Northern Light activity. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Chris, I am looking forward to seeing some Northern Lights. I saw them once when I was very young. I think I was a teenager, and I didn't even know what I was seeing. It kind of freaked me out. I thought, what is that? The green and swirling all over the sky. I didn't quite know what I was seeing. But now I haven't seen them since. What causes Northern Lights?
The Northern Lights, you know, it's funny, with my students, I like to use the story of the romantic view of the sky and how pretty it is and how a nice date that would make. But what you're really seeing are highly energized death particles.
Great. How romantic.
Totally ruins the moment. These particles are basically being flung from the sun, from the solar wind, during, you know, tumultuous times on the surface of the sun, solar storms and things. And these particles hit the atmosphere at incredible speeds and fluoresce, just like the fluorescent light tubes that most people have in their homes and offices. And so these lights are actually sun's particles being kind of neutralized before they can strike the surface and really cause harm. And they occur about they spike every 11 years. The sun has a cycle, and this 11-year cycle, the sun becomes very, very active, called solar maximum. And then, 5.5 years later, it becomes very, very quiet, called solar minimum. And we're actually in solar maximum right now, so we should see increased occurrences.
Yeah, again, I think it was last week that we were told that maybe we could see some even, in the northern latitudes, but it was cloudy as usual for me, so I missed out if I even was going to be able to see them. We have some callers. John in Richland Center is with us. Hi, John.
Good morning, Chris and Joy.
Morning.
Good morning.
I have a question and an observation.
Sure.
My question is, these new planets, do they rotate around in the same tangential plane as our solar system because it's included in the Milky Way galaxy? And my observation was, in 2010, we had a meteorite strike down near Madison, and the sonic boom it created shook all the houses.
Where was that, John, that it hit?
It landed near Madison. Okay. In 2010.
I vaguely remember that. But first of all, what about these planets, these new planets that we discovered anyway? Do they rotate like our planets do?
Okay. That's a great question, because if you had a planet whose solar system wasn't edge-on, let's say you took that solar system you're viewing and you tipped it up, so that, let's say you're looking at the bottom of the solar system, you know, we're way underneath that solar system, as those planets orbit, you'd never see them because they would never go in front of the parent star. So you're ruling out many, many solar systems that can't be detected because of the alignment. So if a planet moves in front of the star and we detect it, it automatically means that we are looking right along the plane of the solar system. I do want to point out, though, that the galactic plane has very little to do with the solar system plane, that all of the star systems are kind of independently moving around the galactic center. And so the alignment or up and down nature of that host star is not related to the galactic plane, really. The meteor impact in Madison, I think I remember that. There was a lot of cameras that mm-hmm. had captured a flash and a boom. Although I didn't ever read about any pieces that were exhumed from that particular crash. Is John still on the line?
Yes.
Yeah, John, we were just looking that up because I do remember it, too. According to the Wisconsin State Journal, it says here that a peanut-sized piece of the meteor that streaked across Wisconsin during that period was discovered near Livingston in the southwest corner of the state, according to UW-Madison scientists. So they did, I guess, find a piece, and it was more in southwest Wisconsin. The fragment was identified as a piece of the recently landed meteorite. So,
if you find that, that can be worth some money. Actually, that's a good thing to locate. I guess the latest meteor in Chelyabinsk, Russia, a couple months ago, that particular meteor was. I don't know. Did you guys hear about the RC on the news, the Chelyabinsk?
No. And we just have 30 seconds before a news break. But can you? So it struck and oh yes, that one that really freaked people out.
Yes. Yeah. Thousands injured from the sonic boom. The meteor basically blew itself apart right above the surface, and so these little light fragments of stony settled to the snow, and so there were grade school children out collecting meteorite samples for major profit.
Yeah. Well, we'll continue talking about all things in our night sky with Chris Janssen, Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District, after we check the latest news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
We are talking about Jupiter and Mars and other planets, stars and moons this hour, and news from around the universe. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up now on 6:37 on this Tuesday, April 23rd. We're talking with a guest about the significance of the discovery by the NASA satellite Kepler, discovering three planets that could potentially support life. And we are welcoming your questions about these planets or other things space-related, be it meteorite showers, comets, northern lights. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Chris Janssen is our guest, Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District. And our next caller is Rob in Madison. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I was just calling to ask a question about if it was possible to get to these planets and how far away they are and what it would take to get there.
Yeah, what would it take to get to these planets, Chris?
That's a really good question. And this particular Kepler system, 62, is 1,200 light years. So even if you wanted to radio them just to say hi, you'd send a signal and it would take 1,200 years to get there.
Wow.
And then if they received it and said, hey, thanks for the greetings. Hi, back. It would take another 1,200 years to get back. So that's just radio, you know, and light communication. If you got in a ship and you traveled there, well, we only have a ship that can't even reach 0.1 the speed of light. I mean, not even close to the speed of light. So at this point in our stage of history, unfortunately, we have to say these planets are out of reach.
Wow, really, really far away. Anything else, Rob?
No, that answered my question.
Yeah, thanks very much for asking it. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And again, Chris, so what exactly makes these planets potentially habitable?
Okay, there's three real factors that people look for when discovering, you know, Earth-like planets, and one we haven't talked about quite yet. It's very exciting. The first one is Terran-sized. You're looking for planets that aren't gas giants, because when they get that big, they have no surface. If you try to land on them, you would be crushed from the gas pressure. Usually they have associated radiation temperatures that are super high. So you want Terran-sized planets. The second piece is you want a planet not too close to the star where it gets too hot, and not too far where it's frozen. So you want that Goldilocks zone, something called a habitable zone. And the third piece is you want a solar system that has had time to evolve to produce what's called a Earth or solar-like metallicity. You want to be able to have the building blocks of life in that particular solar system.
And how do we know if the solar system has had that time to evolve?
Okay, this is another thing that we know we can detect. Have you ever looked at different types of light bulbs? So you see like a sodium vapor bulb compared to a fluorescent bulb compared to an incandescent bulb?
Sure.
They all have slightly different colors to them. And the sodium vapor is very yellowish, orangish almost. Each light signature, each element as it is energized, gives off its own fingerprint or signature in the rainbow, and we can run that light through what's called a spectrometer, and we can detect the level of elements and their abundance in the upper layers of the star, and then we can ascribe if that star has iron and calcium and oxygen, then its host planets probably have about the same percentage.
Mm-hmm. So could there be, human beings and other forms of life wandering around these three planets right now? We just don't know it.
Yes, that is the, we have no way of finding this out. It's complete speculation. But, there could be, just like they could be looking back at our solar system, maybe wondering the same question.
Yeah, that's, How do we find this out? I guess that's what a lot of these missions are all about, but how and when do we find this out if there's other life out there?
Okay, the big thing really we're going to have to build, and it's coming in the next 10 years, hopefully. It's on the books. They are, if it's, the funding is there, we will be able to build these devices. The trick is, that there's these orbiting planets. You see them through the light dips in the host star. Now, you've got to aim a telescope at just that planet, and you've got to receive that light reflecting off of that planet's atmosphere and run that through a spectrometer. And what if you detected oxygen, carbon dioxide, water vapor in that particular planet's atmosphere? As soon as you see carbon dioxide and oxygen, you've almost guaranteed you've got life there.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned to my producer, Amanda Magnus, that there is a project at NASA called LISA that's going to be looking into this?
Oh, yes. When I spoke with Amanda, I was reading about gravity waves at the time. LISA detects gravity waves. There is another project. It's called a coronagraph. Well, that's not the official name. There's no cool acronym for it. The idea is that you would shine that light. You have to block out the host star's light, which is so bright. It's called a coronagraph. It's basically like holding your hand up against a bright object and trying to see something next to the light. And the trick is, because you're so far away, those planets are so close, that you really have a tough time removing the glare of that host star to try to get the light from that planet's surface. It's immeasurably difficult what these scientists are trying to do.
Let's go next to Wayne in Green Bay. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. I wanted to ask, isn't there a broader scientific definition of the word of life than merely carbon-based, needing oxygen, water, that sort of thing? Anything that consumes nourishment in some form and reproduces would be life, would it not?
You're right, yeah. I'm smiling because there's tremendous debate, really good books as well. What exactly is life? You're right. Does it reproduce? Does it consume? Unfortunately, I think what scientists are starting to say is, let's just look for something that we're at least familiar with. If we saw a planet that had a xenon atmosphere, we might dismiss it and say, oh, there's no life there. But there could be life that we've never even heard of that breathes xenon or some type of, situation. So I think we're just trying to find Earth 2 and then recording the data so that if another scientist stepped forward and said, hey, I found a way that, silicon-based life could evolve, then they would be able to go back to the database. Do you have anything in mind that you were thinking of or had read about?
Oh, nothing in particular, no. It's just, it sounded a little bit limiting to limit life to that which is like us.
Right, that was me saying, just to try to relate to this, whether or not there could be a planet with beings like us wandering around it. But it could also just be some kind of amoeba in water or something, Chris.
It could, yeah. Yes. We could be looking at a chicken soup, a planet with little amoebas in it. That would be pretty cool someday to find other life out there. That would be very different.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Did you say that there were some, maybe they were scientists, maybe they weren't, that were speculating on what the life could look like on these planets and they were, sort of alien-like beings?
Yeah, and really, xenomorphology, you could really start looking at, to receive light, we take it for granted. We've got plenty of light surrounding us all over the place. And if you need to, reach up to the tree to pick an apple, your eyes are a certain size to receive just the right amount of light. But if you're in an environment where you evolved where there's 1/100th the amount of light, your eyes may have to be huge.
Mm-hmm.
Or you would have to evolve to maybe your eyes see infrared, the peak wavelength of that output star. So and then if the gravity is 2 to 3 times that of Earth, we're not going to have tall, lanky people. We're going to have very short, stocky, strong creatures that would be able to, move around. And so you look at the data on these planets and you start to assume if they're like us, that's the big assumption, then here are some characteristics that those creatures would take on.
Interesting. Well, we have more questions for Chris Janssen, Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District, talking with him about this Kepler satellite discovery last week, NASA announcing that it has discovered 3 planets in a solar system far, far away that could potentially support life. So talking some about the significance of this discovery, and we're talking about other things that are space-related. If you have a question about anything, any other news from around the universe, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's going to be a cloudy, cool day today, scattered light rain, and some heavy snow still possible in far northern Wisconsin. Indeed, a winter storm warning remains in effect until 10 o'clock this morning for far northern Wisconsin, including Bayfield County. You can expect an additional inch or two of more snowfall before 10 o'clock this morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 11 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, April 23rd. Coming up after 7, we will talk with a guest about the possibility, the probability that more cities will start installing more of these surveillance cameras that played such a big role in identifying the Boston Marathon bombing suspects. Do you have a problem with this? Police say that these cameras can help solve, maybe deter crimes. Others say they could intrude on our privacy and civil liberties. What do you say? We'll talk more about that coming up after 7 o'clock. We are talking about all things space-related with Chris Janssen, Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District, for the rest of this hour. And we have this email from Brent, who asks, how do we even begin to know and understand distances of objects in space? Boy, do you follow that, Chris?
Yes. Let's see. It's hard to put into words. It's a big concept, what the listener is trying to point out. We have to start with something called a light year. And a light year is a misunderstood term. The year, word year is in it, implying a time. Mm-hmm. A light year is a distance. And it's the distance that light will travel in a year.
Okay.
It's a great distance. And astronomers have used these distances, these very large distances, because light travels incredibly fast. And it was really the first big discovery after the Greeks, you know, how far these objects are from us. And how do we get a handle on this? It's mind-blowing, to be totally honest, as astronomers grapple with these distances. How do we measure the distances would be a question I can try to answer. When you examine the spectrum of a star, you can look at something called reddening. Again, you're taking the light of the star into a spectrometer. You can look at the light after it's broken into its rainbow colors and try to determine its distance. You can also, the biggest ones, one of my favorite ways is called the distance modulus equation, where you can look at, I know that star is a 1,000-watt light bulb, but it's really, really, really faint. So I know it's really far away. I know it's a 1,000-watt light bulb because the rainbow colors tell me that it is a 1,000-watt light bulb. And so you compare the absolute magnitude of the star, the 1,000 watts, compared to the apparent magnitude, how bright it looks in the sky. And so that comparison of how bright it is and how bright you know it is determines your distance.
Okay. I wanted to ask you before we ran out of time, too, about the pink full moon, which is we're going to see apparently on Thursday. It's not really going to be pink here, I don't think. It says April's full moon is traditionally called the pink moon, a reference to the pink phlox, one of the earliest flowers of spring, we wish. But this week, the pink moon might actually appear pink in Europe, Africa, and Asia, where spectators will also see a partial lunar eclipse. That sounds cool.
Yeah, and the pink isn't, you know, the flowers aren't causing the pink moon. The pink and reddening is caused by atmospheric absorption, you know, same as why you have a red sunset every night. I was looking at some of these names here, and there are some funny names. If anyone wanted to look up, you know, each month full moon has a name to it, like June is the strawberry moon, and May is the flower moon, July the buck moon, full buck moon.
The buck moon.
Yeah, the sturgeon moon and so on. It's from the Farmer's Almanac. These go way back to Native American times. They really don't have any, you know, astronomical significance. Very similar to a blue moon, does not actually have, you know, it's not blue.
Right, and it's that refers to what, the second full moon in a month or something like that?
Well, the Sky and Telescope back in the 70s had produced that assumption, and it turns out it's incorrect.
Oh.
It's not the second full blue moon in a month. There is another definition. You'd have to check it up. Off the top of my head, I don't remember, but it's...
But anyway, yeah, when I saw this, noticed that there was going to be a pink full moon on Thursday, I thought this was some, you know, amazing thing. But that's just the name of the moon, naming it after the flower, apparently.
Yes, I wish. You know, maybe Cancer Awareness Month should be on board.
Yeah, there we go.
April.
We have other callers. Dan and Nina is with us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Chris. This is your wife's cousin calling, and my question for you is, what is the current funding for space exploration? In your opinion, is this adequate, and what do we as the public get from space exploration?
Hi, Dan. The Boy, that's a really good question, the practicality of science, because as taxpayers, you know, this should have some payback. If we just do pure science all day long and we don't get any product from it, you know, what's the value in that? Besides knowledge, let's see, two questions. One, what is the current funding? Not great. It used to be a lot more. We have to really subjugate ourselves to robotic missions at this point. Human missions are far too expensive. So we're really just doing robotic probes, satellites, space telescopes, and those types of things. If we were to, say, enhance funding, or what do we get back as a society, it's usually the byproducts of these, you know, aerospace engineering products. So there's so many things that come about, from battery technology, printed circuit board technology, even bandwidth tightening for our radio communications. There are some big, big, big projects that we use on a daily basis that would never have been done if government funding didn't fund the project for a space mission. So a third-party company wouldn't have the capital to take on some of these large projects and just open it up and say, now anybody can use it, because it's basically open source. And then companies can then capitalize on those discoveries that we all paid for all of our benefit.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. Well, let's spend our last few minutes talking some about things we might see in the night sky in coming days and weeks. Any cool constellations or anything else that we might want to keep our eyes peeled for?
Yeah, right now out above the sunset, we've got the planet Jupiter, which is right near Orion. You'll be able to see the belt of Orion for a couple more weeks. And it's bittersweet. You get to say goodbye to the winter constellations. Jupiter is right there blazing away. And then the opposite side of the sky, over in the south, east, you'll see Saturn is rising. So those are two planets you can check out tonight. Also watch for the summer constellations to start to rise. When you start seeing Lyra and Vega, the summer constellations coming over the east horizon, it's always an exciting time.
Yeah, I think I did see a photograph of Orion that someone took, and it was pretty outstanding. I guess the belt was really blazing for some reason.
Probably the exposure on the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Orion is one of the brightest constellations. I think he is the brightest of all the constellations.
And there are some new or different apps that are available for us amateur astronomers?
Yes. I looked at both of them extensively yesterday for these exoplanets. I cannot highly recommend the iTunes app Exoplanets enough. It's a free app. It's really put on by the Kepler mission is the people who make this app. It is beautiful, and it is updated very regularly. On the Android market, there is app called Exoplanet, not nearly as polished, unfortunately, but you will be able to get, you know, what you need as far as discoveries, and you can keep count. You can put a little widget on your phone to tell you when new planets are discovered.
Very cool, very cool. And we have just a minute to go. Besides what's in the night sky, you know, in this week, what is it that you're, are you waiting for this comet Ison later this year? Is that the big deal this year?
Yes. I remember Hale-Bopp, when it had come through, I sat outside just for hours and just stared at it. It's so beautiful. And if Ison is even partially that bright, or there's some predictions about seeing it in the daytime sky, and that is going to stop everything. People are going to, across the country, across the world, they're going to walk outside, and they're all going to observe this beautiful object. I'm really looking forward to Ison. I hope it holds together.
I do, too. Looking forward to it, and always looking forward to talking with you again. Thanks very much for being with us.
It was my great honor to be on your show, Joy.
Chris Janssen, Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District. And thank you for all of your calls as well. Thanks to Amanda Magnus, who produced this program, and for on-air production. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for on-air direction. And thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. We will talk about the probability that more American cities are going to be adding surveillance cameras in light of the Boston Marathon bombings. We'll talk about that coming up after the news. This is the Ideas Network.